Ladies and gentlemen, the opening address is given by the Professor of Forecasting and Innovation at De Montfort University, Leicester, James Woodhuizen.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank Howard and Peter, and especially Kathy Hayward, for making the mistake of inviting me this morning. I'm very grateful to them. You'll notice that the tomato throwers have been strategically placed far away from me. I'm very grateful for that, but I've been given a lapel mic so I can run fast enough. I think we face in FM and in all sectors of society, really, quite a big choice ahead of us over the next 5 years, and that's between sticking to our guns and really innovating and doing the easier stuff, putting off till tomorrow what we should do today. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. And I thought, on a mind-numbingly boring note, we might begin with the EU's recent white paper on energy and climate change and so on, with which I'm sure you're all familiar. And it's quite an interesting paper, really. It not only wants to raise energy efficiency to cut carbon dioxide, but it also wants to reduce energy use. This would be an unprecedented change in Europe or in anywhere, really. The whole history of raising energy efficiency in workplaces as elsewhere has never been accompanied by a reduction in energy demand. So I'd urge you to have a look at that. It really would be something if they managed to achieve a 13% cut in energy use in 13 years. But I think we can see a kind of displacement activity going on here, where the budget for the EU among 25 nation states for energy R&D amounts to precisely 2% of the budget for the common agricultural policy. And therefore, I think, you know, when Greens come along and say this is greenwash, I'm very rarely sympathetic to Greens, but I think the level of commitment to this enormous task must be questioned if we're only putting 2% of CAP money into the labs. And I think if you read the document, you'll find that what prompted the whole affair and Barroso's press statement about it just in January was they were very worried about oil price rises. They ought to be less worried now. They're very worried about President Putin. And they're also worried that if you develop large-scale alternatives in energy production, for example, biocrops, that itself would be unsustainable. Now, we've had about four, five, or six mentions of the word sustainability already this morning. It's quite interesting to observe that any large-scale alternative to carbon-based fuels and carbon-based sources of energy is also feared by Greens. They don't want too many windmills or too big windmills. They don't want too large a commitment to biofuels and so on. In fact, the document's quite full of the suggestion that Europe should be telling Brazil how to run its agriculture after the great example we've had of the last 50 years of the CAP. So I think really my first point to you is read the documents, ladies and gentlemen. Read the documents. You know, be forensic in your approach to these reports. Because I think we also face a moment, and as a forecaster I'm very interested in that, where you only have to sort of say, oh, well, the Stern report shows that, you know, it's, the debate is over, the consensus has been arrived at, we've all got to go carbon neutral, the science determines the politics, end of story. Now, how many of you have actually read the 700 pages of the Stern report? I've read 70 of them, and that's 63 more than most people. And I just thought it'd be worth having a look at what he actually said, because be forensic. What he's saying is that the Gulf Stream will collapse, the ice sheets will melt, all sorts of funny things will happen to the methane and the permafrost around the world. And while there's lots of uncertainties in modeling it all, he says, what we should be thinking about is amplifying feedbacks, catastrophic climate impacts, non-market impacts, can you imagine that, on human health and the environment, on migration. As we know, migration has really seared the British economy in the last 7 years. We've really done us a lot of harm. and also all kinds of conflict. Everything that could go wrong will go wrong. And if you read the report, you'll find he assigns a 10% probability to mankind not making it to the end of the century. So on that upbeat note, I thought, you know, have a look at what he says, because he's an economist, he's not a scientist. It's also important to work out who is saying what and what credentials they have for that. And just in case you didn't get the point, you know, there's a sort of Dante-esque inferno awaiting us all, where what begins with coral reefs collapsing ends with dangerous feedbacks and rising sea levels and so on. And, you know, if you haven't done it, you better run a check on all the sea levels, because, you know, quite easily 7 centimetres is turned into 7 metres in the lurid imagination of our tabloid friends and also many Greens. Now, just before people think that I'm a right-wing climate sceptic in the pay of ExxonMobil, I should say I agree. I believe in anthropogenic climate change. I think there is climate change. I think we're responsible for quite a lot of it. But I put it to you, and I urge you to discuss, because it is supposed to be a learning conference, is climate change, ladies and gentlemen, the same thing as climate catastrophe? There's a difference. Right? There is climate change. We are not facing a climate catastrophe anytime soon. And the way we deal with climate change is a very important issue for facilities managers. So take a look at the documents. Take a look, for example, at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How many of you have read this document put out in January? If you listen to the BBC and nearly everybody else, including even the august FT, they will tell you that 2,500 scientists have now agreed and, you know, the debate is over and that's it. Well, actually, if you download the document, you'll find that 33 scientists put this summary report, which consists of 13 pages of text. It's a summary which was line by line drafted by governments and nation states, not just scientists, and that the real report is due in April, which will be subjected to even more government intervention. And the big report that's due in April is actually one of three. This one's on the physical science, the other two are on other issues. And if you look at who actually ran the headlines in all of this, who made the headlines, I should say, was it a scientist? No, it was an environmental consultant, Achim Steiner. He grew up in Brazil, so obviously he's very sympathetic to all of the worries that we have about the rainforest and all of these things. He's in fact an Austrian, and he says, look, the question mark is removed from global warming, and he's got all of these expertises that he claims, first-hand knowledge of civil society, governmental and international organizations. He's in NGO land, and he tells us that a chill went down his spine when he read the report. I have to say, for once in my life, he would say that, wouldn't he? So do have a look at that. You might look at David Miliband's draft climate change bill if you want to fall asleep over 170 pages. You better have a look at that. Unprecedented enabling powers given to the government, like our friend from Interserve already drew our attention to, increased regulation. The enabling powers given to the government in that document are quite extraordinary. They will be able to change the rules of your game without recourse to Parliament. Now, haven't I heard that somewhere before? So do adopt this forensic approach. And what it all means is well summed up by the government-funded Carbon Trust, which is that really the innovations that are being asked of you are to do with going carbon neutral in order to maintain your brand. And I want to say to you, is that the substance of facilities management over the next 5 years? Is that really what we want to do, to improve our brand of our employer or the client that we have as if we're outsourced by going carbon neutral? I can't answer all of these questions in 30 or 40 minutes, but I do urge you to debate them. And I do urge you also to adopt in FM as elsewhere. It's the key to the outside audiences that I think Peter rightly enjoins you to address. You must adopt the Voltairean principle. I disagree with what you say. I defend to the death your right to say it. If we don't do that, then we really are going into a Ptolemaic kind of consensus, not a Galilean one. There needs to be dissent. And I bring to you this morning a quotation from Oscar Wilde. You might care to write it down. Discontent, ladies and gentlemen, is the first sign of progress in a nation or in a man. So let's, you know, value that, because he wasn't being funny just for once. Dissenting voices are important, otherwise we will really collapse into sustainer babble. So what are we dealing with here when we're forecasting the future? We have a five-year emphasis. I think governments demand, well, what's the worst thing that could happen in my facility? Or when will the White Cliffs of Dover really be overwhelmed by the frogs? And you then a scientist say, well, I think we've got a tipping point here, and everybody reads Malcolm Gladwell very uncritically. And then what you do is you do a sort of Nixon domino theory, where you add all the ice sheet to the, you know, thermohaline circulation, the permafrost, and, you know, the Viet Cong lead to the Chinese, and it gets worse and worse, and you get to the very worst case scenario. And then you do something, the reverse of forecasting, you backcast it. And you say, well, look, right now, in order to prevent doomsday and a second flood, where have I heard that before? We've got to take all of these actions every day in facilities management. And the first of those actions is to have a fire drill and to have a rehearsal for what's going to go wrong and to make these sort of chill down my spine sound bites to the staff. I submit this is not genuine innovation in architecture, in environmental design, in the final frontier of the modern open plan office, acoustics. We'll probably hear a fair bit of that this morning. That is where most people would like their innovation done. And it's not exactly the official first line item in the agenda. It is stuff that substitutes for a real politics of the facility and a real economics of it all, and indeed, I might add, for actually dealing with climate change. So when I was asked to prepare this speech, it was before the latest budget, so I'm afraid I've gone back to the last budget, but have a look at that if you really can, because Gordon Brown committed £50 million to microgeneration and that very well-known new Labour product, micro wind. And then in the usual fashion, he repeated it four times in the space of the budget document, which makes for a bigger budget, as we all know. And it's not a lot of money, especially if you compare it with nuclear decommissioning. But it does cover 30,000 buildings. Many of them, ladies and gentlemen, are schools. Do you know why? Because you parents don't get it. Right? Only kids have the right awareness, and perhaps they'll be informing upon you in due course. Where have I heard that before? And I thought, well, look, you know, let's have a look at the document on which he bases all of this, right, to be forensic. And it is actually a document put out by Hub Consultants for the Department of Trade and Industry, just before it's abolished, in March last year. And the DTI document is called Our Energy Challenge. And here I have a windmill above Croydon Car Park. It generates enough energy to power eight homes for a week. And if you read the Hub Consultants report, which is quoted by the DTI document, they say while some energy installations only produced, or renewable energy installations, only produced very modest levels of energy, in other words, none, the behavioural impacts in terms of energy awareness and efficiency were still considerable. The qualitative impacts of microgeneration can be substantial, presenting a living, breathing, and emotionally engaging face to energy consumption. Now, that's what I mean about the consensus, because what it's really saying is it doesn't matter that it doesn't make any energy, as long as there's a feel-good factor in there. And I have to say, call me old-fashioned, but I thought science was fairly important in all of this, right? That you actually had to generate some energy. Of course, I do agree with Tony Blair, because he's told us that children are the future. Did you know that? Some of you may have been laboring under the misapprehension that they're the past, but I'm here to tell you that, you know, generations as yet unborn have rights, and you better, you know, do right by them, because they're never going to forgive you the way we never forgave our ancestors for the First World War and all of that. We're always thinking about how angry we are about the First World War. So do check it out. You know, check out the documents, check out who's saying it, check out the difference between the tabloids and the original, and check out, above all, the science. And it brings to me lesson one of it all. They will be asking you not just to look at your own carbon emissions, but of all of your suppliers. The whole nature of supply chain management in your business is going to change, and they're going to want to know, like John Lewis wants to know of its suppliers, not only are they carbon neutral, but do you, Mr. Supplier, have a cycle park in your office, and so on. Now, that's really the way to move ahead, isn't it, in facilities management. Hopefully we will see, and this is an unfunny bullet point, we will see some macro generation around district-wide or city-wide combined heat and power, where there really are some possibilities, rather than the B&Q, David Cameron, power gen to insulate your loft, because they know such a lot about lofts in power gen, those kind of micro solutions. So to do with all of this innovation I'm calling for, think big. Because it's not going to work if you think small. And if you look at the government's own document, that DTI document, about you selling it all back to Centrica from your facility or from your home, you know, they're very worried that even that won't work. And if they're worried, I'm pretty worried about it. There is going to be obsessive metering everywhere you go. And I give a very generous scale requirement that if you're not generating more than a megawatt, you might as well buy it off the national grid. I know the national grid is centralized and therefore basically a fascist plot. But I would suggest that, you know, below 1 megawatt, you are just doing feel-good stuff. Tesco does 2 or 3 megawatts per facility. So let's get serious. Otherwise, we're going back to the land of Lilliput. And meanwhile, check out what is also happening, even in carbon-based fuels. This is what VW is doing with engines. 270 miles to the gallon, right, of diesel. So before we insist on a cycle park on everybody's part, let's take a look at some old installed base technologies and not write them off in our desire to condemn the 20th century. Okay, that was lesson one. Now, if you read the Harvard Business Review, which I know you all do, you'll find in October a very interesting article about the Challenger disaster. You know, when they had the foam on the side of the space shuttle, they looked at the foam, they said, we're not going to investigate that. We don't think there's a problem, there's no threat there, and the rest was history. And that made me think a bit about, you know, how we interpret the sort of threats and spills that you happen in your kind of profession all the time. And it's quite an interesting article. You'll see that what they're asking for is that you have to have a systematic way to analyze and respond to weak signals, and this is one of the reasons why the climate change discussion is important. So I asked myself, well, what are these people worried about? The man on the top left is Gregory Ferris. He's world supremo of global business continuity management at Morgan Stanley. The man in the middle is Callum McKenzie, running the Financial Services Authority, you know, the people who called off the hounds from BAE. And on the right, you know, it's Patricia Hewitt in charge of Eastern Europe, the health service. What are they? Well, at least some of you are getting the jokes. Great. What are they worried about? Is it global hedge fund meltdown? Is it corrupt practices in the arms and Saudi part of the world? Is it private equity? No, it is, in fact, bird flu. And all over January, they were having a regular rehearsal. Every Monday, the 60 City of London institutions had to write to the FSA saying what they would do, given that they had lost a quarter of their staff, a half of their staff. And as Gregory Ferris told the Senate Committee of Inquiry, have we got enough face masks to face the future? Could that be a displacement activity from innovation at all? I mean, we all know somebody who's died from bird flu, don't we? Like, we know somebody who's died from genetically modified foods. So, just in case you weren't worried enough, let me tell you, the BBC has discovered mermaid's tears. I hope you know about that. They're little bits of plastic all around the world. You can get a big government grant for researching them, and people do. So, Really, we're dealing with a world where the threats seem to be everywhere, and we might deny, and you might laugh at, some of the threats that I satirize, and yet the threat mentality, the risk consciousness, the fear culture, is really out there in your profession as in others. I'm pretty grumpy about that. Why? Because a cursory inspection of what's happening in health, when you do the forecast, you have to collect other people's forecasts. And you've all got to be more in the forecasting business than you are already. So this is one I took from the newspaper that runs the government, The Guardian, in 1999. And what it says is, from authoritative EU scientists, the usual suspects, basically what it's saying is that you're all dead by now from mad cow disease, right? And you look at all the health panics we have, and it's very relevant to your facilities, the medicalization of the workforce and the workplace, right? Not innovation, but medicalization. ADHD, it's what you've got listening to me. Anorexia, well, I failed to put obesity in there. Disco TB, it's the tuberculosis you pick up in the gala event tonight. DVT, we now know you can get that, you know, from sitting at a desk. We'll stay off falling sperm counts. And, you know, remember the McPherson report said there is no evidence that radiation from mobile phones fries a brain, but nevertheless we strongly suggest with the precautionary principle that you do not use them and that children, especially children, always win the argument on children, do not use them. Phthalates, anybody? If you lick a rubber duck for 200 years, you will become a laboratory rat. So, and what's the really striking thing about all of this? The really striking thing is that life expectancy has never been bigger, right? That we're all becoming as tall as the Dutch, I should know. Right. That the Japanese will eventually beat the Americans in basketball and all of these things. Right. Even in the third world, for a lot of the third world, you'll find life expectancy on the up. So before we panic about the health threats to your workforce, get it in perspective. Right. Get it in perspective. Right. And even if you take a very serious problem like gambling at work, which the BMA has decided is a physical addiction at the very moment when the government has decided it's the key to Peter's urban regeneration, or at least casinos are, you know, is it a physical addiction? Some people are a bit sad about gambling. There is some gambling at work. You know, people play patience and the National Lottery and so on. But is it really something to be scared about? So I want to say it's lesson two about future threats. Collect the forecasts, suspect the forecasts. Don't amplify what is genuinely weak. Distinguish real risks from perceived risks. Did you pack those bags yourself? No. I didn't pack those bags. No. A man in a white towel, he gave them to me. And okay, well, that's all right. Then. On we go, right? What we're dealing with is a feel-good factor that doesn't do anything for security. If you want to do something about security, don't waste people's time asking questions like that. So there's a, you know, when the mobile, you know, when we switch off the mobile phones because we know how many planes have been downed by mobile phones, we know that in those luggage compartments, nobody has left their mobile phone in their bag on. Everybody switched them off. That's why we're alive. Right? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So there's a perceived risk there. Is it the same as the real risk? Jeff Mulgan, the strategy unit advisor to Blair for some years in Downing Street, said the job with Al-Qaeda now was to organize the paranoia of society. Quite a task for government, but no doubt they can do it. So I want to say that the innovatory dynamic to what you do is more important than the management of risk of what you do. And I know you'll say I'm irresponsible, and I'm not saying there are no risks out there. I'm saying that in today's culture, if you stand back from the everyday, you will realize how many barriers there are to innovation and how many false fears there are that are making us do these displacement activities. Some fears are well-founded. I don't deny that. But it's important to stand back from it and recognize that the zeitgeist gives us a lot of risk aversion. If you look at just what's happened in the last year, you remember the Greens were telling us that the MSC Napoli was going to be a kind of Torrey Canyon when we all realised it was a BMW opportunity. And I think, you know, when we look at all of these things, the slightest spill is going to lead to more regulation. Right? Then the government and the scientists who get the funds from all of this stuff and everything can rush in, John Reed style, and you seize upon a nasty incident and you make more regulation. So that's my third lesson to you. I'm sure you're doing it. Build yourself a little forecasting unit to anticipate health regulation around food, around epidemics. Remember, obesity is something you can catch now. Did you know that? And around noise. And maybe there is a case there, because it is hard to concentrate in the office. And all of that, I'll come back to that. So if you're not watching the DfE, the HSE, more than you are already, I know you're watching them, but a lot of the time you're reacting to them. You need an inside man there, preferably with a brain and some independence. And you need to have a little unit to tell you what they're going to do next so that you know how to disagree with it, organize a campaign against it, recognize when a genuine issue is at issue, and in that way not be confused or outwitted by events. Now, the fear of accidents, the BMJ, a British Medical Journal, said there was no such thing as an accident a few years ago. It was all done by human error and could be fixed. If you read this report, which I wrote about in Kathy's wonderful journal, you'll find that, you know, the 20, 25 people who died in the Texas spill of BP just 2 or 3 years back, it's 25 too many, but it's about the largest disaster that's happened in an oil installation in America for the past 20 years. Right? Get it in perspective. It's 25 too many. I don't deny that. But it doesn't mean that you have to go totally crazy as a result of all of that. Okay, well, I want to say some controversial remarks about outsourcing, because I know there's so many consultants here, I thought I'd be able to run out of the building faster once I'd said this. Our next Prime Minister, if it is him, he still has the ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, I think, loves to displace decisions somewhere else, in PFI, to the Monetary Policy Committee, and also he proposed a board for NHS policy. I know a lot of you in government, so we'll have a little government interlude here. Now, let me say, my criticism of PFI is not the usual one, which is made by The Guardian and Socialist Worker, and broadly is nicely summed up by this Steve Bell cartoon. You know, a large number of American multinationals, you know, rip off the taxpayer or the trade unionist, depending upon your persuasion. You know, they go through revolving doors. They're always in government, then they retire to the private sector or the other way around. And that's the problem with PFI. No, that's not my problem with PFI. My problem with outsourcing is that very often it's born out of a sense of risk that you no longer have the capability to do something. So you ask somebody else to do it. And there can very often be, ladies and gentlemen, an abdication from the responsibility for innovation in all of that. All of the consultants here know well, you know, you employ a consultant to tell you the time. And you give him your watch to do just that. And that, for me, misses that shaping the future element, that sense of agency, which we must retain in times when we all feel so impotent about globalization and terror and everything like that. And I love the title that Peter or whoever it was came up with it, Shaping the Future. You shape the future. Don't let the future happen to you. And by outsourcing these decisions, then I think you do let the future happen to you and you abdicate from what's important. Now, if you look at the policy of an independent, so independent it will be, NHS board, first of all, who the heck will they be? Like, who the heck is in your regional development agency? Do you know? Did you elect them? Do you know who your MEP is? We don't. At least you can elect an MEP if anybody bothers to go. But an NHS board, that's not going to be electable. More importantly, if fear of political scandal in the NHS, or MRSA, or mass lawsuits, drives outsourcing, and it often does. Right? Remember, we're talking about a government that declared that lip balm at airports should be stripped from every individual at Heathrow, because we know that lip balm is, you know, really the greatest threat to Western civilization. The results of all of that are going to be risk aversion, not innovation. And you're going to get exactly what we have in the NHS, where we can't even implement for $12 billion a patient record system, because we've got to get every tiny detail right. We live in a surveillance society. It's all so terrible. And you're going to have checks and more balances and more bureaucracy and more delay. I don't have a problem with you doing business from outsourcing. Why should you be specialized, you clients, in everything that goes down? Other people will be more specialized. But I do have a problem when it becomes a substitute for innovation. If you look at what the Work Foundation says about innovation in government, I've got to get my professorial glasses out at this stage. I'm sure you're tracking the Work Foundation. What they said was, C equals D times V times F, which is more than R. Did you know that? And what it means is that change in the public sector is equal to dissatisfaction times vision, it's the George Bush vision thing, times the first steps that you take, and that's all got to be bigger than staff resistance, because we know those staff, they're a bunch of Luddites out there. You know, they're really useless. And we're the ones who must got to change this. And there's a key thing now to look out for, behaviours. If you see it in the plural, that's when I reach for my revolver, right? You know, I never heard it in the plural, but I want to tell you that your behaviours are not good enough. And what they say in the Work Foundation is that there's too much innovation in public sector IT. Scope creep. The government's too eager to take risks over IT. And what they miss is that, of course, actually it's risk aversion that's gold-plating all these government IT programs. It's not because everybody wants to build an empire. No doubt there's a bit of that. But what they miss is how fear is what's leading to these massive costs. In the Work Foundation critique of government IT, they mention risk 56 times, innovation twice, and then Alexandra Jones, whom I don't know, I probably will never know after this, told the FT that public sector should not be about cutting-edge innovation. Well, that's a great recipe for what Ian Watmore calls transformational government. Don't innovate. In fact, if you read Transformational Government, November 2005, you'll find that he says, you know, that there is a role for new technologies in the public sector, no doubt in public sector facilities management. For instance, mobile phones. Now, that's great, isn't it? In 2007, after 20 years of mobile phones, we say, maybe we're going to commence to begin to start to get ready to draw up a plan for you to, you know, pay your parking meter charges through a mobile phone. Mm-mm, that really is transforming government. So I want to say that outsourcing, if you're completely unwilling to innovate, is a distraction. If you read the literature of change management, you'll find that it actually begins with the US Army in the Second World War. When they lost forces, they went to the families, a bit like Saving Private Ryan, and what families took to be change was loss. So really what we're saying when we go on about change management, another term that I think you've got to be very careful with, is that, you know, we understand staff will be in denial about the changes that us enlightened, properly behaved people will be introducing. There'll be a stage of resistance, then denial, then they'll get behind it. You know, pat them on the head, because they're going to be a bit like Al Gore in his movie, you know, beset by loss, you know, alcoholic wife, all the rest of it. And I think it's extremely condescending to staff, who are the main source, as we know from W.H. Deming, through quality circles in the past, and even today, they're the main source of many innovations. Secretaries know how to innovate and what goes down, rather than change managers who wish to condescend. So watch out for that when you're outsourcing things. And do not spend your time in litigation and contract negotiations, because it's a substitute for innovation. You know, men in white coats are better than men with white wigs. And I think we need to remember that. And do not abdicate responsibility for innovation in IT. If you look what's happening in IT, you know, I'm often skeptical about it, But if you go one better than Facebook and go to aboutface.com, they will give you already a little thumbnail of all of your FM staff or all of your staff and the email address. And the next thing that's going down is that you need to organize your lieutenants to give a one-minute video clip to their people every week saying, you know, what I did this week, what I did on my holidays, or what you should do next week. That is coming. That's the promise of Web 2.0. And we need to be thinking about those innovations rather than about having another fight through the courts about that contract. I said I'd talk about centralized versus decentralized methods of FM. Let me say, with IT, the discussion's fairly irrelevant. What is important with the new Cisco $70,000 video conferencing suites, where you can look at the whites of their eyes and so on, is to eyeball people, your Chinese counterparts or whoever, and say, are you innovating? It doesn't matter whether it's centralized or decentralized, the issue is innovation, adopting IT, moving forward on sensors. Sensors are going to be important in all of these contamination scares that we have. If you automate it, maybe we'd be scared less. Okay, well, I'm beginning to go, but I thought I'd say a little bit about stress, or what the Americans call information fatigue syndrome, otherwise known as work. And I want to say that, you know, if you've ever read George Orwell about going down a mine, you know, you can't buy what people say about stress now, right? Because nothing that you are doing or any of your people are doing is anything like what it must have been like going down a mine. And it's time to get it in perspective. You know, Cherie Blair is terribly stressed out in her job, as we know. There's all those conference speaking fees to gather in and invoice for. But I think one source of stress that is thoroughly neglected, which you need to take up, is not what goes on in the workplace, because we actually displace a lot of our anger and so on onto work, right? We blame work for a lot of things and everything. But outside but linked to work is the transport crisis, a part of that wider infrastructure crisis that I already hinted at with energy, where we will not have enough energy supply to go forward with, given that the EU labours under the misapprehension that we'll need less of it, you know, less energy demand. Now, if you read about transport, and I'm afraid it's another report, you can see that Rod Eddington, if you read his report, this is in a nation that builds 40 miles of main roads a year, the fifth largest industrial power in the world, right? Builds 40 miles, and even that's too much for our green friends and so on. And George Monbiot in The Guardian wants airports closed down the runways, is what he's saying. And what Eddington is saying is, no, we don't want more new roads because it costs money. We need sort of Cone's hotline. You remember that from John Major, right? More slip roads, better slip roads. We want to streamline everything, and that way we'll feel better at the end of a journey, as he and Richard, the bejerseyed one, clearly do after this journey, right? And, you know, it's got the usual branding. You get Eddington twice on the cover because there's no egoism here. And I just want to say that, you know, before you demand or somebody demands of you the cycle parks and all of that, right, let's just take a look at the Shanghai airport to Pudong maglev link that the Chinese have built. The Germans gave up because the Greens stopped them building one from Hamburg to Berlin. And on the bottom right is John Redwood MP, better known as Vulcan. He's the only person who upholds maglev in this country. It's time for him to have some allies, not politically, but in terms of upholding maglev. When I went to Liverpool, when I go to Yorkshire and I say, look, it takes 5 hours to get from Liverpool to London, that is a bit stressful on a Sunday. It's time to make it 40 minutes. I'll tell you, they're lapping it up north, right? So there are allies out there. There are some rational people out there. A lot of people up there also want houses, new houses, which would be a real change, given how few we're building at the moment. So I want you to take up cudgels for new, sometimes carbon-based, technologies of transport. And if you want to do something about stress, you might, you know, try to fix that problem. That would be genuine innovation. Cycling to work is all very well, and I'm a cyclist myself, I'm no headbanger, but we need that wider perspective. And the wider perspective is that rather than worrying about staff, you know, being too stressed out, when are they ever going to switch off, we need to recognize that we've barely switched them on. If we envelop them in a zeitgeist of fear, where, you know, work used to be work, but now it's work-life balance, where it's my crackberry, you know, because I'm so addicted to that. Is there anything we're not addicted to? And one of the things that Gordon Brown addressed the UN on was the need to switch off standby lights. Well, I did a little calculation using the latest official statistics. And even if you had only 7 appliances in your home or around your desk in the office, actually in the home it's more like 9 and so on, and if you're like slow like me and you take 10 seconds even to find the socket and then to turn it off, if we all switch off our standby lights, we could regulate the appliances out of existence, but if we spent our time doing that, we would be involved in a massive expenditure of society's time. Mistake. What we need is a comprehensive approach that does recognize that teleworking is growing, finally, that it leads to more transport journeys, not fewer transport journeys. A call prompts a visit prompts a call. And there is a need for you to think about remote IT facilities and remote working and all of that backup stuff. But the primary need is not to fear Al-Qaeda bombing your facilities, or I think you should rather fear the Eddington approach, which wants to road price your employees out of getting to work. And all the IT vendors, if you read my column in IT Week just this week, are going to be salivating at all the metering opportunities there. Why I favour telework, why you might favour telework, is that people just might get time to think and the audio environment to think and therefore come up with innovations. It's a much better argument than the business continuity argument. So my final lesson, ladies and gentlemen, is about etiquette. Can we cope with these new ways of working that IT, telework, and all of these things are bringing upon us? And I want to say, can we cope is the wrong question to ask, because it immediately has us as victims of fate, rather than doing what Alan Kay, the inventor of the Apple interface, said, that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Right? That sense of agency that I've talked about before. Now, is etiquette, especially as laid down by the Victorians, you know, the main thing that we have to worry about in the workplace of the future? Right? I want to say that the biggest problem we're going to have with crackberries becoming more universal in terms of etiquette is that Peter is going to send me an email that's written all in caps because he didn't know how to take the cap locks off. And I'm going to say he's a complete nutcase. You know, it's all in caps, this message. And I'm going to write him a departmental memo saying never do that again, you know, because it really had a bad effect on the coronary system. If that's what the problem is that we need to be dealing with, I suggest that that is also a displacement activity, that it has nothing to do with the potential for crackberries to move ahead our productivity, the productivity that Gordon Brown, after 10 years, is still very exercised by. And I think we can handle it. We can cope. And that's what our kids are doing. We don't need to sentimentalize our kids, but we do need to recognize that human beings are very adaptable. So I'll skip that next slide because I'm nearly done. I just want to say that the focus on etiquette and the focus on loss and the focus on victimhood and litigation and all of that stuff is very widespread through society. I mentioned Al Gore. This is what the leader of McDonald's, as was, said about leadership. And it's not just him. If you look at January's Harvard Business Review, they came to an astonishing conclusion in 2007. No leader is perfect. God, I didn't realize that. You know, no, I always thought they were totally perfect. Right? But the reason they want to tell you that they're imperfect in January 2007 is because leadership now, in your profession as elsewhere, is now identified with Führer Prinzip and is therefore a bad idea. Now, I don't mind Peter talking about community-based FM, And I don't mind our friend from InterServe talking about partnering, but even he observed that partnering was a much abused word. I love partners, as many as possible. I love the community. I love the community as well, but don't let that absolve you from giving a lead, from stepping up, making a mistake, you know, having people have a go at you, and actually moving society and your profession forward. Because, you know, when they invented the Sony Walkman, they didn't do a focus group first. You know, they didn't. They just went ahead and did it. They took the initiative. The Chinese are not doing a whole lot of focus groups right now. I don't like the regime, but at least they built a maglev, which was more than we Europeans do. So, just to end, innovation is about, what is it? It's about the development of new knowledge and new experiments and new taking of risk and mistakes being made and getting your fingers burned. It's not just the McLuhanite transfer of best practice, right? Of sort of getting in bed with your local university and grabbing all of their innovations. That too is an abdication. You have to make the innovations, not just hope that through different media you can get hold of them. You do need to listen to users and your staff, but you don't have to believe what they claim. The final word must be with you. That is what exerting leadership is about. It means being a first mover, not just a fast follower. It means being a Sony, not just a Panasonic. And it means combating prejudice, and the kind of prejudices I've explained that very much are articulated by the state, means tackling prejudice on carbon, where there is a problem and where there isn't a problem, on health, the medicalization of the workplace, and about PC mannerisms in the workplace. Forget about that stuff. Let's have some genuine IT. Let's have some airco in your hot summers that are going to come. The Greens will hate you for it, because airco, bad news, you know, maybe we'll really get the naturist perspective as an alternative. Some might celebrate that. But, you know, we need new technology in this country and throughout the West. I just want to end with a quotation which I will read from the guy who invented, you know, Renaissance poetry in this country, because I thought he think Sir Philip Sidney, he of the cloak fame, said a really great thing. He said, "Nature never set forth the earth in so much tapestry as diverse facility managers have done. Neither with so pleasant rivers, fruitful trees, sweet-smelling flowers, nor whatsoever else might make the too much loved earth more lovely." What a great thing to say. I like nature, you like nature, but we're even better than nature. I know that, you know, really pisses people off who believe in fish rights. And so on, right? But I want to say of the fish and of nature, her world is brazen, the facilities managers only deliver a golden. So I hope over the next 5 years you can really debate these issues and deliver a golden. I'm sure you can. Thank you so much. Well, since it's not a Labour Party rally, I'd much rather have criticisms than questions. And when you criticise, I've heard from Howard that you will not be hauled off by a security guard, you know, even if you're 80. And I make a serious point there that, you know, dissent. Let's have some dissent. So,
hi, Dave Arminus from FM World Magazine. Were you saying that you need some stress in the workplace to become innovative? Or were you saying that we're getting rid of too much stress in the workplace by use of teleworking and things like that?
Well, I raised an interesting... I don't think I said either of those things, but it's amazing what goes down. But, you know, I think stress is a good thing a lot of the time. I think if you're hinting at that, I'm right with you. You know, I get a lot of stress when, you know, getting up and make a speech like this. But the result is that you laughed a bit, you know. So stress is not all a bad thing. You know, making a deadline is something that young people need to know more about, right? And I'm sure there are stressful moments in the modern workplace, but all I'm saying is the religion of stress, the stress management consultants, and all of that is leading to a situation where people regard the workplace not as a center for wealth generation, but as a center for diseases, for illness, for mental health problems, along with a center for gambling, play, among young people getting laid, and all of these things. It's all fine, and all of these things go on in the office, you know, well, quite a lot of them do. But it isn't the same as generating some wealth through innovation. And all I'm saying is let's focus on that, because there's plenty of pressures to go off that point. That's the only point I'm making. I'm just going to show I'm youthful here, you know.
Dave Wilson from Macro. This is an industry that is very keen on procedures and processes. And Ralph Waldo Emerson says that a fearful consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. And I wondered sometimes, yeah, you can.
And see me afterwards.
Yeah, thank you. I'll get a point for that. But I just wonder if we're not stifling innovation in the way that in this industry in particular, we insist on having everything written down and doing everything consistently. And we should use procedures to allow people the freedom to do more innovation, because they should take place of the routine activities, not the new things that need to be done. And I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I've got to be very quick. I think, you know, a bit like with speech making, if you can't remember it, then it isn't worth saying. So, you know, the 170 pages of David Miliband's new report on the draft climate change bill, you know, I defy anybody to know what the point of all of that was, right? So there is a role for procedures. I'm not a headbanger about that. But if your staff can't pick it out of the back of their back pocket on an A5 sheet of laminate, or they can't regurgitate it on a Monday morning, you know, when they've been having a wild weekend, then you've got to question the procedures. And you've got to ask yourself, is all this procedures stuff not just bureaucratic, but it has a kind of like regulation, an independent dynamic of its own, you know, which is displacing our attention from what really should go down. It's not just that it's a long report, it's that the length of it is going to distract you from what should be the main event. And that's what we've got to watch out for.